Thank you very much indeed, Madam Ambassador, and to your co-facilitator, Ian McConville. I'm sure you're going to do a splendid job. It's not an easy task, given all the views on the table. I'd like to divide my comments essentially into two components, one to focus on the ISU and one to say a little bit about the ISP. I've heard a good deal this afternoon that the UK is in full agreement, and I'd like to highlight in particular the comments made by the distinguished representatives of Malaysia, South Africa, Argentina in particular. I think that what they have said is very telling and very pertinent to our discussion. On the ISU, first of all, well, I think our view is generally well known. We've laid it out in our working paper 15 from the Patrick Committee meeting in August. And essentially, we're looking for a program-driven ISU, one that reflects the work program that we're hopefully going to agree at this conference. We're not about creating jobs for job's sake. There has to be clearly defined concrete tasks to be performed. We see the need for at least two new slots in the ISU, one to support future work on science and technology, and one to support work on cooperation and assistance. And by cooperation and assistance, I mean both Articles 7 and 10. Other things that the ISU clearly needs to be able to do more effectively, picking up the points that Daniel Feeks pointed out in his presentation immediately before the lunch break, that they have been constrained by their travel budget to attend and liaise with other organisations and states parties. We co-sponsored a paper with Japan on the importance of cooperation with international organisations, and there clearly needs to be a capacity within the ISU to do those tasks. And this will be even more the greater if we are going to agree on the kind of expanded work programme that most of us in this room favour. The ISU, in our view, would be funded from the regular budget. And we should also think about quite seriously whether we need to be making the ISU a more permanent feature. The idea that we have to renew it every 5 years is unsettling and disables long-term planning. So we should be looking at a longer renewal period at this conference that will enable greater predictability in planning. Now let's turn to the nature and content of the intersessional programme. Again, our view is laid out very clearly in Working Paper 15 about how we see that being structured, so I won't go over the details again, but I just want to highlight a few general points. Earlier this afternoon, Article 12 was mentioned in our discussions. It's clear that only ever talked about one review conference, and the word it used was to review. It didn't say anything about decide. And that one specific topic that it referred to was science and technology. Now, since then, it's been the collective wisdom of the states parties to have further review conferences at various intervals. And if one looks back at the language, it's quite clear that they vary in frequency. The review conference is just a feature in the overall architecture of our convention. It is not a supreme decision-making body. That is not recorded or agreed anywhere in the documentation, which of course is voluminous, that's been generated over the decades. Our practice has been different. Decision making has been devolved down to subordinate bodies. This was done at the second review conference. A group of experts was mandated to design the formats and modalities for the first CBMs, and they were adopted at the conclusion of that meeting. They did not have to come back for blessing or endorsement by a review conference. We did the same again in 1991 when we expanded the consultative committee arrangements. And there in the text, in the final declaration, we make it very clear that the consultative committee shall decide on its business. The verification experts meeting that ran in 92 and 93 again had decision-making powers, and that would be further refined at a special conference if a majority of states willed that such a conference be convened. And the conference would decide whether to run forward on that report. Of course, they did, and we ended up with the ad hoc group, which itself was enabled to take decisions and to complete its task by the fourth review conference or at a special conference thereafter. The implication clearly being that that special conference would have decided or otherwise to adopt the protocol. So decision making is not a novel concept for meetings other than review conferences. And as many of us have indicated this afternoon and previously, decision making is seen as fundamental in a new, more effective intercessional process. We've also had reference this afternoon from my distinguished colleague from Norway about the importance of an oversight committee to make sure that we have the effective functioning of a new intercessional structure. We have certainly proposed such an approach, and we think that would be an essential element in the architecture of a new arrangement. Having identified the core activities that we'd like to see, which would be science and technology, cooperation assistance, which is Articles 7 and 10, as well as focusing within an annual meeting on other issues such as national implementation, we can perhaps find different ways of reflecting these requirements. Perhaps there's no single model for doing this, but we could probably find another set of arrangements which would capture the necessary desiderata for this, which would be something that is action orientated, something that is flexible, responsive, effective, efficient, and timely. It seems to us that those are the fundamental criteria for a new intercessional process. It represents a significant advance in what we've managed to achieve in the three preceding intercessional processes. Thank you very much.